Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Medicare spending is among the top drivers of the nation's expanding debt. Everyone knows it. It's not up to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to set policy, though. It's up to Congress. For some details, Federal Drive host Tom Temin turned to a senior fellow at the conservative American Enterprise Institute, James Capretta.
Let's talk about the structure of the Medicare system. I mean, I think people typically assume it's a pay-as-you-go system, and it might be that. But like Social Security, there is a couple of trust funds. How do they operate, and how do they affect the spending in ways that might be a little bit subtle?
There is one trust fund that is kind of like Social Security, the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund. That was the original idea for Medicare. It was added on to Social Security so that people paid payroll taxes during their working lives and then got this hospitalization protection when they retired at 65. Then they added a second part at the time of enactment of Medicare called Part B, the SMI Trust Fund. And this trust fund is not pay-as-you-go like a payroll tax trust fund. It's a premium. So people pay premiums, and then the government contributes the other 75%. So it's basically a 25-75 split with the beneficiaries paying a premium and the government paying for the rest. It's pay as you go in a certain way, but not in the same way people understand it with the Social Security payroll tax. And that's a big now. 60% of the program, Medicare spending, is in Part B, not the hospital side, which is Part A.
So is the answer to simply raise the premiums or cut the benefits? I mean, the formulas are what they are, just like the tax code. They're enshrined in law. And therefore, what are the trends showing us about that secondary fund?
Well, I think the big issue here is that we're going through a major demographic change, right? So you just have a much larger retiree population relative to the size of the workforce. It's been happening for about 15 years now. It's going to continue for another 15. And so you just have this big bulge of people going into the program. And how do you pay for that? So you probably do need to look at, well, maybe we need to raise the payroll tax somewhat. Maybe we need to raise the premium somewhat to make this more affordable over time. The conditions that were in place when the program was enacted are not the same as they are today. And so you have to make adjustments.
Yeah, so it does parallel Social Security in the sense that the pyramid is almost upside down. That is, the payers in by payroll tax are supporting a larger number of people that are collecting.
That's right. It used to be more of a pyramid, of course, with smaller numbers at the top and bigger numbers at the bottom. It's still kind of a pyramid, but the base is not quite as big compared to what it was years ago relative to the size of the retirees. And so that is a shift. And then there's the healthcare component, which is that this is not just a retirement program, but it's also a medical program. And of course, there's pressures associated with the U.S. running a system that is a little bit more expensive than our peer countries.
Right. And so given the fact that it's not politically possible to end the program, I don't think anyone seriously proposes that. It seems like things can be done both on the demand side and the supply side. The supply side, it's kind of like higher education. The costs run away out of control outside of any normal market in any other field of economics that you see. So have you got any ideas on that side?
Yeah, there are lots of ideas on the supply side, as you know, and they're big disagreements. So this is not something that easily fits into something where you say, oh, everybody will, you know, join in and say, yeah, that's the answer, right? So there'll be ideas that say, look, we need to make this more efficient. How do we make it more efficient over time? There's many provisions that were in the Affordable Care Act from 14 years ago that tried to pay for care, what they call value-based payment, to try to make the hospitals and physicians work a little more efficiently together to drive down the costs, even as the quality would go up, accountable care organizations and the like. Then there are people who say, well, just cap the prices and cut them even lower, right? Tell the people providing the services, hey, you're going to get paid a little bit less. That, of course, is a tried and true method. And the problem there is that they've squeezed that quite a bit already, and it's hard to know if you can get any more out of that. There's always a little bit of room, though, I would say. There's some more ways to squeeze. And then there are folks that are worried about Medicare Advantage, which is the private insurance component of Medicare. And there are big disputes and maybe some evidence that the Medicare Advantage plans are getting paid a little bit above what they need to be paid to do the services they're expected to do. And so they're overpaid and how do you get that money back? And so they aren't overpaid without, you know, harming the beneficiaries in the process. So those are some of the things in play. None of them easy, though. That's why this is a big problem.
We're speaking with James Capretta. He's senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And then on the demand side, that is the government side that is providing these benefits in concert with people paying in, even into their old age. It kind of comes in from one agency and goes out in the other. What are some reasonable proposals that Congress, if they decided to think about it rationally, could look at?
You know, one thing is to redesign the benefit a little bit, not necessarily for the people on the program. So there's a lot of always people say, well, you're changing things and, you know, people are retired. So just to protect everybody on the program, say, no, this would be prospective. But the benefit's a little bit outdated at this point. It doesn't have catastrophic protection. You know, it has this A and this B and this D, all with different deductibles and cost sharing rules. They probably ought to get to a combined benefit that is a little bit more rationally designed with one deductible and one cost sharing structure for all the covered items. And then say to the beneficiaries, hey, you could pick, get it through a government managed process like is the traditional way, or through a private plan. And we're going to have them kind of compete with each other. This is an idea that's controversial with some people, but still out there is an idea. It's called premium support. And if you selected a plan that was more expensive than the average, maybe the beneficiary would have to pay a little bit more. And if they selected one that was less expensive than the average, maybe they get to pay a little bit less in a premium. And it's through that kind of a process that you might get people to say, okay, let's find less expensive ways to deliver this so that we can attract more beneficiaries. And so that's the kind of idea that might be out there in the future. It is controversial. I don't want to kid you about that.
Sure. Well, all these things are. And what should the financial goal, do you think, of this be for Congress? Because, you know, just currently you've got, you know, major medical care programs, according to the CBO, costing $1.5 trillion, which is more than the discretionary so-called budget, roughly equal to it, way above defense. And then, you know, Social Security is another $1.34 trillion. And those trends are only going up. What should the financial goal be?
I think the financial goal should be permanent solvency for these programs, right? I mean, this is a multi-generational program, right? It's supposed to last across years and decades, be there for workers and retirees and future participants, even those who are just being born this year. So you really should be designing something that has some stability to it and self-corrects so that people always understand it's always going to be there and it's not going to break the bank. So as our demographics change and our cost structures change, build into the program some self-correcting adjustments. So if the premium needs to go up a little bit, it goes up a little bit. Or if the tax rate needs to go up a little bit, it goes up a little bit. Or if you need to adjust what we're paying for services a little bit or deductible, you adjust them a little bit so that the whole thing stays stable and financed and not something that's driving up the federal debt to these astronomical levels that you've been talking about. So I think that should be the financial goal. And it's doable. I mean, the corrections are large, but it's doable. But you just got to get into it and start making some adjustments.
Yeah, for the politicians, it's not so much understanding the finances is what I would call the psychological pieces of it. Fear over, you know, catastrophic loss or worry over affordability of the premiums and so forth as you go into old age, and then the demagoguery of any kind of a change, the one side will say to the other, look what you're consigning grandma to falling off a cliff type of discussion.
Right. I mean, I think it's pretty nonsensical to assume that the U.S. is going to do something that would be dramatically different from what Medicare already is. So whatever Medicare is in 2040, it's probably going to be recognizable to whatever is being provided today. It's going to be changed, though, to make it somewhat more affordable budgetarily, one way or another. That might mean they just pay the doctors and hospitals even less than they are today with whatever consequences might come from that. But, you know, some adjustments are inevitable, but it will be recognizable as a insurance program for health care for the elderly, and that will be there going forward.
Well, we'll never get to the point where, say, you know, spinal fusion costs the same as an oil change.
No, that's not going to happen, right? And maybe we don't want that to happen, right? I think you want your your spine physician to be very highly trained, which means that he or she will probably charge you a little more than that.
James Capretta is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, speaking there with Federal Drive host Tom Temin. We'll post this interview along with a link to his Medicare findings at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency, and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.